Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show, a show which a reviewer on iTunes, I think, described as full of guests who do not understand their own privilege. So please go to iTunes and give us a review if you enjoy the show. Today, we are joined, of course, by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you? How are you on this freezing cold day in the middle of winter?
Well, I'm wearing a jacket, which is unusual for me on this show. I'm pretty sure that that guy who says we don't understand our privilege is going to be back to flagellate himself again tomorrow.
We have it is, of course, today the winter solstice, so it is the longest night. Sara, how are you, Ms. Sara Gon?
I am wearing a dress, which doesn't really help one way or the other on the show, but I feel I need to pretend that I'm in an office.
So what you're saying is we're dressing up fancy for today, I suppose.
Yeah.
Of course, the great thing about working from home is no one knows ever whether you're wearing pants or not, but that's not a question for discussion now. Let us move on to
Wasn't there a guy on CNN who forgot to switch the camera off and then went off and did stuff?
Yes, Jeffrey Toobin, who's, I think, actually now been reappointed back to be a guest on CNN. But,
I think he should move to radio.
Yes.
Oh, well, sure, you know.
I'm sure he's only the most famous victim. Anyway, Toobin aside, let us dive into the serious news of today. And the first thing we can talk about, I think, is the debate around the opening of schools. So, as most people know, and as every parent knows who has school-aged kids, the government has been pretty strict about how schools are supposed to be run during COVID. They were completely shut for a while, and they've been sort of half shut for a couple of months now. Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga says that she wants to open schools fully despite COVID. She says that the country needs to avoid an academic disaster. She said, while there are disruptions at our school, we remain fairly stable. This week, we reported 100 schools were disrupted by COVID. We have more than 25,500 schools in the sector, which means most of our schools remain stable. We are of the view that schools must remain open. And saying so, we are not insensitive to comments raised about rising infections. The position we will be presenting to the National Coronavirus Command Council is that COVID-19 cases must be handled on a case-by-case basis and in a differentiated approach, said the minister. Very sensible stuff, I think, from an ANC minister. Unfortunately, there is quite a lot of pushback against what she is saying. On Sunday, the Educators Union of South Africa said that it would physically shut down schools if the department did not close them immediately. Speaking on ENCA, their spokesperson said the decision to keep the schools open showed that Angie Motshekga did not care about the lives of teachers and pupils. He said, quote, "We are going to physically shut down schools, working with community organizations we've consulted with. We're giving the minister 1 week." This is very similar to something that EFF leader Julius Malema recently said, where he said schools should be closed to protect pupils at all costs. He said, quote, "Schools must close with immediate effect because our children are going to die. We give the minister 7 days to close schools because we will not allow our children to die. Private schools must lead this campaign because they have the facilities to teach online. Let our children be safe." Sara, let me start with you. Am I right in my assessment that the minister's got the right call here? And what do you make of the EFF and the union's demands?
Yeah, I would more or less support Angie Motshekga. I think the problem is that she does face a potential disastrous educational year, and education in this country is disastrous at the best of times. So, A, we really can't afford not to have a decent educational year. B, is most schools don't have the resources that the private schools have to do work online, and so that's not an option for many for many schools and for many working parents. One of the problems with going into this very this sort of in and out lockdown is that we actually need, particularly South Africa, which doesn't have the resources or the capacity to do things properly with regard to vaccinations and things, is we actually need a certain level of courage to be displayed by teachers. Mask up, keep your distance, make a plan, do something. They are at risk, some of them, certainly. But the children, even if they get it, this thing about our children dying, it's emotional blackmail. It would be very unusual to have a child die of the disease.
In fact, I believe that all the data seems to suggest that COVID is, for under 18s, less dangerous than regular flu.
Yeah. Well, the strains of regular flu particularly affect the young. And part of the reason is because their immune systems are still developing, the response to the flu is so vigorous that it can cause heart failure, etc. This is not the case. It's just the other way around with the COVID. And I think, to be quite honest, we have to be prepared to be a little robust about it. And for Julius to talk nonsense about children and for the unions to want to protect teachers, they should know more about this than they seem to. It's selfish, and I do think it actually takes a backseat to making sure that there's a year of education.
For what it's worth, the minister has promised that during July, particularly, I think the school holidays are probably coming up in July. I think that's the case. Teachers are going to be prioritized for voluntary vaccination. Terence, what do you make of this whole mess?
Well, you know, I must say I have a great deal of sympathy for Angie Mashego. I think that she's got a particularly difficult job at the best of times. I think every education minister in this country inherits more of a mess from those who went before. So, I'll say my heart actually, on a human level, goes very much out to her, and I don't think that she's faced with with an easy choice here. But I agree broadly with Sarah. Children do appear to be less vulnerable. And, speaking to people who work in education and in that sort of township or rural environment, what one teacher said to me is that you have children who, the choice is literally between being cramped up in a sort of leaky shack, where the congestion, whatever, and the possibilities of distancing are remote, or coming to an environment which is better, not great, but better. There's the whole business with the with school feeding schemes. I think one of the more unconscionable things about the lockdown was how that was stopped. So yeah, looking as far as the EFF goes, I think their default setting is, wield as much power as you can. If you can stop someone from doing something, that in itself is kind of a good thing and shows that you've done something. The sad thing is that even under under the best scenario you could name, there is likely to be, some child that will come down with COVID and will die from it, and that is likely to be the story that everyone will fixate on. Understandably, if not entirely to be justified. So yeah, as this unfolds, my true sympathies do go out to a minister who, in this case, has an impossible job that she really doesn't have any good choices about.
I can't help but notice Malema's comment in there about private schools must lead the way here, and one wonders whether this is going to be the spear point of a attempt to go after private schools. Am I being completely paranoid, Sarah, or do you think that that's
I don't think he wants to go after private schools per se, because I think his children are at private schools, or a child is at a private school. I think what
he could probably afford to send them to schools out of the country.
Yes, well, that's an option. I think what he's trying to do is, in being seen to be the champion of the safety of the children of South Africa, if private schools lead the way, then they too can be without schooling for the length of time, whatever length of time kids who go to government schools will be without, and then it all will be equally bad.
Go ahead, Terrence.
Look, I just think that there's one or two things that need to be pointed out here. First of all, not all private schools cater to very well-off parents. Mm. This phenomenon of low-fee private schools, because you have such a dreadful state sector, you have parents of very limited means willing to put an enormous percentage of their income into sending their kids to something that's outside the system. Secondly, very interestingly, I know parents who send their kids to state schools, and I mean, you know, very good, well-regarded ones. Online teaching for those schools is simply not an option, because even though they may be located in middle-class community or upper-class communities, and you know, most of the parents have money, there are enough who don't have the computers and whatever. So, I mean, in one case, with one, as I say, well-regarded state school that I know of, the kids were being given a sort of package to take home where you had to go and collect it. And they would have sort of one session a week online if they had access to it to speak to their teachers. So, you know, even in those circumstances, I can guarantee you that there are private schools in very similar situations. Mm.
Can I just make another point about the other function that schools play, and that is for parents to ensure that their children are somewhere safe while they're at work. And as soon as you have kids staying at home, someone has to stay at home, so a job may either be lost or at best salary will be lost. And it's a social factor that I don't know if the unions have or the EFF have put that into consideration.
Yeah, one thinks not. I must say there's also this aspect of physically closing down the schools. I mean, that's the threat. I don't think we've seen it yet, but, you know, it may still be coming, in which case, you know, this started sort of with clicks, and surprise, surprise, with there being no proper response to that, it looks like it's going to continue with regards to things that are not private companies. So it's a very good example of the slippery slope in action. Anyway, any final thoughts before we move on?
You know, I think that that could be one area where the EFF overplays its hand badly. I think that it works on the principle that any publicity is good publicity, which I think generally is a sound bet to make. But, you know, irrespective of whether it's in, you know, Bokeng or Posmasburg, and irrespective of the demographics of the parents, I think when you start to mess with people's kids, you can expect a massive blowback.
Yeah, I think the EFF is going to be in big trouble if it shows up at a school anywhere in the country and tries to stop children entering the school. Mm. One suspects that the parents are not going to respond very well, especially if it's in a poorer community.
Well, in a poor middle class community. I mean, they've pitched up outside schools and made a hell of a lot of mess and anger over other issues. So I'm sure they would target similar schools. It would be very injudicious for them to go for poor township schools.
Mm. All right, let us move on to a story it's not really making big headlines, but it's something I think worth considering because it's a phenomenon that's not really talked about that much in sort of high-flying media circles, and yet it's a real problem in South Africa's rural areas. So police from Mount Fletcher in the Eastern Cape have reported that an elderly woman was attacked, stripped naked, and beaten by a mob after being accused of being a witch. The police spokesperson said that six people had been arrested in connection with this. The police had been summoned to the scene, by what they said were concerned community members. The police arrived with municipal officials, traditional leaders, and officials from the social development department and tried to rescue the elderly woman from the mob. The police spokesperson said, eventually the elderly woman was taken away from the mob to a place of safety. Police opened cases of assault with intent to cause grievous bodily harm, kidnapping, and imputing witchcraft. They arrested six suspects between the ages of 30 and 40. All six suspects remain in police custody and are expected back in court on the 22nd of June. The provincial police commissioner said that youth's morals have been eroded by social evils and a lack of education into community values. Quote, young men such as these are supposed to be protectors of the elderly rather than being violent against them. They're expected to be more enlightened, to know chasing elderly people on untested and unsubstantiated allegations of witchcraft carries with it serious repercussions. So I guess this is an opportunity to talk about this problem of witchcraft and witch attacks and things like that, which kind of goes on in the background. There are not that many of them in South Africa, but there's enough to make you raise an eyebrow. They're usually in Limpopo, but of course this one is in the Eastern Cape. So Terence, you said you've written about this a couple of years ago. What are your thoughts on this phenomenon?
Look, this phenomenon and its equivalents throughout history and throughout the world, there's certain commonalities. It often takes place where there is a great deal of social stress and disputes. In Europe, for instance, it's often forgotten that you know, witch trials were not actually common during the Middle Ages, certainly not executions. That tended to happen in the early modern period, where you had where those countries were in upheaval and there was a great deal of war, the 30 Years' War and whatever. It became easy to see, you know, that when your reality is completely turned upside down, you look for something to blame. And, you know, if that's a witch or the devil or whatever. Now, in South Africa, I think you can very much point to similar sets of phenomenon. One factor, the work I did was in the late 1990s, and there was actually a commission of inquiry appointed by the Limpopo government to look at this phenomenon. I think it was a Judge Ralushai. They identified a number of drivers. One of them was the sort of cultural beliefs. Now I think we all remember that rather disturbing video from the University of Cape Town with the students saying that, you know, people can call down lightning or whatever. Now, I don't think that's great for the future of scientific inquiry in this country, but it does indicate that these are widely held beliefs, and you know, one shouldn't be patronizing. You know, people hold all sorts of religious and cultural beliefs that are made difficult to justify rationally. There's that. There was also the legacy of the political conflict, and I think this is actually where the idea of burning came from, or at least, you know, got a particular lease on life. That, you know, you didn't just kill, you had to incinerate. And I think a lot of that, and the Ralushai Commission actually connected that to the political violence in the 1980s. Property disputes are a big one. And this is often why around the world these allegations are often directed at an old woman or elderly woman, because there's often somebody waiting in the wings to take over a particular plot of land. A sort of mob psychosis can take over, and you know, you rush in and deal with it. There's also the sense that there is something, you know, malignant and unseen, so you can't turn this over to the police to deal with. I understand one of the reasons why there have been suppression of witchcraft statutes is to try and take this out of the hands of the mob and try and put it into the hands of a magistrate. South Africa actually has had legislation on witchcraft. I think it went right into the 1990s. This was like not customary law. This was, you know, statutory law. I think the UK still had a witchcraft act going into like the 1980s. Those may not have been applied, but you know, it does indicate how how deeply rooted they are. But I think the big point is this, that a country under this sort of stress, you know, people will find some way to express that frustration, whether that's against your Bangladeshi storekeeper or your Zimbabwean car guard or your witch.
Now, I think that point about stress is exactly right. I remember reading an interview with people who had participated in anti-witch violence in Limpopo. And they said something along the lines of, look, we know this person. And this person recently came into a lot of money. And we know that they're not the kind of person who could ever be successful. And so they must have cheated in some way. And this was in a very, very poor community. And so, you know, you can see here that this is kind of jealousy, desperation, all these other nasty social things coming to the fore here. Sara, your thoughts on this? You talked about... Terrence, you wanted to add? Sorry.
No, just that you know... You also have a lot of urban legends that swirl around this.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of using, you know, body parts for muti. Apparently, it does happen, but the scale on which that is expressed, you know, becomes amplified in the telling. I mean, in the 1980s, we had these satanic panics all over the world. I mean, we had a couple of them in South Africa.
Yeah.
At one point, it was claimed there was some, I think there was something like 100,000 active Luciferian devil worshippers in Johannesburg, which meant that, you know, you probably couldn't step out your house, like tripping over a pentagram or something. and this was being spread through, you know, even people in the police were spreading this. Apparently, there was a very senior policeman, but you can never actually get a name. And yeah, you know, this person who comes into money, well, obviously, we know this, obviously.
Sorry, I cut you off there. You were going to say.
Just picking up on Terence's point, I mean, referring to those sort of satanic experiences, I mean, there were some really, really gruesome murders and assaults taking place at the time, and it was mostly amongst the white community. So I think belief plays a very, very important part when you mix in then the social problems and cultures around it. It's an interesting area because it's where the real horror of gender-based violence and attempts to stamp out gender-based violence intersect but don't really meet one another, because as long as there is these social factors and this belief system exist, as Terence says, it doesn't happen a lot, but you will have elderly women, usually widows, who are on their own. They are vulnerable by virtue of all those. They can't put up a fight. They don't have anyone to support them. So it's a very unpleasant thing. And you know, when one looks at the sort of what I call the phony gender wars of the woke movement, I would go with Ayaan Hirsi Ali's advice that if you want to really see some of the things that women have to suffer, travel.
Yeah. No, exactly. They're not arguing about, I don't know, the correct pronouns or bathrooms or something here in Mount Fletcher.
They're having almond milk in their lattes, yes.
Yeah. Here's an interesting thing, just to bolt another layer of complexity. There was a rumor that was going around in Khartoum at one point, this is about 10 years ago, that there was a Ghanaian man who was apparently some sort of, you know, wizard, who was shaking people's hands and that made their junk fall off. And this was being spread by smartphone message. A society that's capable of using smartphones but still believes that there's this West African sorcerer who's coming around shaking your hand and making your reproductive organs drop off, even though no one can actually show a face of it. I mean, you know, there's dreadful things can come when you can put like technology with
So the reporting on this story doesn't actually mention how the mob started, but I would not be surprised if a viral WhatsApp in that local community was not at least partly to blame for the story at some point. This is a story we didn't have time to talk about today, but I'm sure people have seen the news about these supposed diamonds that were found near Ladysmith. And of course, it turned out to be just quartz, so completely worthless. But thousands of people flocked to start digging in the dirt, hoping that they could strike it rich. And yeah, it's another sign of the social stress. People are desperate. Mm. People are looking for some quick way to turn things around or something to blame for their problems. That's almost supernatural. And yeah, it's It's not going to get better until things like the economy get better, actually. And we're really seeing the costs of our poor economic state here, I think, in a real way. But let us move on to our last story for today. So there was a little bit of buzz on social media, particularly amongst the woke crowd, about South Africa's wicketkeeper and batsman, Quinton de Kock, who was criticized for, during a test match against the West Indies, most of the players either took a knee in at the beginning of the game in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. Some players raised their fists also in solidarity with those players. Quinton de Kock did neither. He was asked afterwards why he did this. He said, "My reason, I will keep it to myself. It's my own personal opinion. Like Lungi said, it's everybody's decision. No one is forced to do anything, not in life. That's the way I see it. That's just about it." Of course, this produced quite a lot of outrage in certain very online circles. There were some people who said that he was basically endorsing racism. There were some people who said that he was being callous and cruel. Sara, your thoughts on this topic?
I think he was being Quinton de Kock. As far as I know about the character, he's not that articulate, fairly straightforward, and probably quite brave. I think he's quite brave. I mean, I would like to embark on some witch burning of some of the people who wrote these opinions, because they are so anti-freedom. They are so illiberal. He's basically being criticized. He didn't do anything untoward. He just didn't do anything and didn't say why he didn't do anything. And it's not for these paragons of virtue to tell us why we should or should not take the knee and for what reason. It seems like the South African players had been fairly mature about it. They'd spoken about it. They'd agreed that everyone could do what they want or not, and it wouldn't be held against them. And you have this sort of thing where he shouldn't be allowed to keep it to himself. Well, what is he going to do? Is he going to tie him to the stake, hang him from his cricket shoes? I don't know. You know, it's just, I don't know if they realize how bizarre they sound. And then there's another point, and that is that, you know, I think this taking the knee to BLM has become real nonsense, because BLM is associated, is the organization. You cannot say, no, well, this is not, we're not going for the organization, we're supporting the idea. My feeling is create another idea. But what I really am annoyed to see is that 1 year on, virtually, the management hasn't said, right, guys, we've done this, move on. The only people who are dealing with these sort of things, I think, properly are the crowds at the soccer matches in England. They don't like it. They're booing, and everyone's getting very self-righteous about it. It's enough.
Terrence, your thoughts briefly before
we close. Look, I defer to the great one who was Elvis Presley. He was asked about musicians getting involved in Vietnam War protests and whatever, and he said, "No, I'm just an entertainer." And I think, you know, at some level, that's possibly, you know, where you know what one has to realize. No one has to have an opinion on everything. There are reasons why, you know, you may take extreme umbrage with Black Lives Matter. And I think Sarah Sora makes a good point. This is about endorsing a particular movement and a particular approach. I may have severe problems with that. I may have religious problems with taking a knee. I know of one Joburg City councillor who would not get up during sittings and go to the bathroom because you had to kind of like nod to the speaker. And she believed this was a type of, you know, bowing, which she refused to do for anyone but God. There are various reasons why people would do this. And yeah, you know, this guy is just a sportsman. You know, and for the ultimate couch potato like me, I probably couldn't even identify him.
Oh, shame on you! No, he's not just a sportsman; he's a very good sportsman. In the last innings, he did well. Not so much in this one; he went out for a duck. But no, the point is, his value lies in being a good wicketkeeper and a good batsman. What's going on between the brain or in the heart is completely and utterly nobody's business.
Right. Mm. And I think
he will be always on my mind.
Have you seen the latest documentary?
For me, the most disturbing part about the anti-racism movement, whether you agree with this analysis or not, is I think beside the point, beside this point, which is that it is totalitarian to demand action. Yes. It's one thing to say stop doing something, and it's another thing to say you have to do X. You have to say this. And that, I think, is the truly terrible part about this.
Absolutely.
Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please like it. Please comment. Please do all those things. Share. Please leave us reviews on iTunes if you enjoy the show. If you don't enjoy the show, please don't leave us reviews on iTunes. But I'm sure you're not listening if that's the case at this point.
Anyway, come on, I'm thank sure you much.
Oh, excuse me. Have a wonderful day, everyone, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Fringe Show.